Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry. I'm your host, Andrew Jelina. With me in studio is Nasheen Milana. Nasheen, welcome to the show.
Hi, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming in, and we appreciate you coming down and being a part of the show. Can you tell us what got you interested in software or software development or technology in general way back in the day?
So I didn't go in thinking I would be in the software or technology industry. I just wanted to be an engineer. And what got me started into even pursuing engineering was physics. And specifically, my physics teacher in ninth grade had a big influence. And I remember really getting excited about the electron when we were learning about atomic theory. And what really fascinated me was the fact that it's invisible. It's a very elementary particle. It has the characteristics of a wave and a particle. It has such a profound impact on our lives. It touches pretty much everything from electricity to electromagnetism. And I just wanted to understand how to harness it and make it useful. I didn't really think like, oh, I want to go figure out the meaning of life and why do we exist. For me, it was more practical about how can we leverage this awesomeness and do good things? And that's how my journey started. And then when I wanted to go to college, I specifically wanted to get a degree in electronics and communication engineering because I was really interested in the communication aspects of how to build systems. And I had my undergraduate project. I got the opportunity to work for what's the equivalent of a defense here in India. And at that time, I was fascinated by stealth technology, and I was reading a lot about the B-2 bombers. I'm generally not a violent person, but what really interested me was that something as big as a bomber could defy the radar, right? And I was like, and that was my research topic. I really wanted to understand how radars work and how the stealth technology, what is behind it. And at that point in time, computers were a very scarce commodity. They were actually in India when I was growing up, they were in air-conditioned rooms that you had to get a specific time to go in. And so as part of my project, I would go travel far from home, like go by the city bus and then go clean up, enter the room. And the thing I would do is literally program in C and Fortran to build out these models of really trying to understand the impact of the equations, trying to model them to really understand how you build. I think in the specific example was like I was trying to get a filter to do some processing of the communications. It was really hard. You know, there's a lot of trial and error, and this was just the computational piece. This was just like writing a bunch of for loops, making attention, you know, that you didn't have like a floating point error somewhere. And then doing the graphs was even harder to really figure out what the patterns look like. And I think at that point we were using some third-party software. I don't remember, but that's how I really got started into really understanding how you look at systems. And then after I graduated, I really wanted to come to the States as an undergrad, but I couldn't, that didn't happen. So I came for my master's and I specialized in signal processing. And when I went to my lab first, they told me to use the software called MATLAB. I was like, what is that? And when I programmed first in MATLAB, I was just blown away that I didn't have to know C or C++. I could just program in math. Like I could take my filter equations of convolution and just like punch it in. And then I could actually draw plots by just giving commands. And I thought that was the best thing since sliced bread as an engineering student, that I could really focus more on the problem domain. In MATLAB, a lot was about trying to reduce the number of for loops and vectorize your solution. So that's essentially how I got into science and then realized I liked engineering, then realized that a big part of it is getting computers to understand what you want to do. So I come from a very engineering background rather than a computer science background into the profession.
Where are you from originally in India?
I'm from Hyderabad, which is a over 400-year-old city in India.
And that's down south?
Yes, it is in south of India.
So spicy food.
Biryani is the thing from Hyderabad, and it's also very famous for pearls. And there's a certain form of bangles that you get, which are also very famous.
Do they have idli and chutney there too?
They do. That's definitely a South Indian thing, and a lot of dosas. And that's like biryani is definitely the signature dish.
So you make the decision to come here for your master's degree. What was it like coming from India to the United States? Was your family concerned, you know, with our daughter going off there? What was that like?
Yeah, they were extremely concerned. Well, I have an older brother. I have like three siblings. I'm the youngest in my family. My brother, who is a physician, he had left India while I was still in high school. And his experience, I think, though professionally was good, it culturally, I think there was a lot going on at the time. And so even though I really wanted to come as an undergrad, my parents were very concerned about the drug problem in America, is how my brother, I think, phrased it to them. And I think the other part he was really concerned about was, I think at that point in time, he was in New York, New Jersey area. There was a lot going on in terms of Asians and specifically people like Indian women wear the bindi. There was a moment at that point where there was this group called Dot Busters or something. And there was a lot of concern for people of the Indian community. And that kind of deterred my parents. They were like, when you're a little bit older, maybe you can go then, and probably now is not the best time for you to go. So,
yeah, but before you had told me, I had never known about that, that whole problem in the 80s and 90s with people not being welcoming of Indian folks.
Yeah, I mean, I had a cousin who was here too, and I feel like people do this when there's not an understanding, maybe, or tolerance for different cultures, it happens. But, you know, to your question about when I first came here, how were things different for me? I feel that from a technology perspective and the quality of life perspective, very different, right? Like the air is much cleaner, there's less population, there's less noise. When I got off the airplane, that was the first thing I noticed was, oh my God, I can hear myself think here. Literally, first reaction, right? And when I was growing up in India, I traveled a lot by public transport and I would come home almost every evening with a migraine. It was just like I was allergic to dust. When literally my first day in the US, I did not have a headache. I was just surprised how I didn't have headaches. And so that was just definitely different. And everything seemed to move much faster and more efficiently relative to when I grew up. I could get water anytime I wanted. That's not always a given. You fill water, you store water when I was growing up, and you always have electricity. Well, actually, I take that back.
Almost.
Almost. But I really like that I could be much more independent here and that I could have access to a lot of different things, which was very hard back in India. Like I could go to the lab anytime I wanted and use equipment. And the professors were also very accessible. So I would say it was very refreshing for me to be able to have that access as a student when I first got here.
So as a big fan of MATLAB, where do you end up working?
At the MathWorks. And that was actually, I think, one of those intangible things in life. I would not have expected that, you know, using the product as a grad student, that I would actually forward 3 or 4 years, actually maybe something more like 3 years, that I would be instrumental or one of the persons co-leading the effort to actually create a student version of the product. So that was very surreal experience for me, like using the software to actually designing and developing a native, because at that point MathWorks was using a lot of distributors to sell our commercial product to students. But at one point they made the decision that they wanted to sell a shrink wrap project. And that I would say was a very exciting project and a very satisfying experience for me.
Now, you were there for quite some time. How did the company grow and change while you were there? And how did you grow and change while you were there?
Yeah, the company, when I started there, I think we were about 250 people. By the time I decided to move on 19 years later, it was over 3,000 people. And we were from an office in Natick to a multinational company, having acquired a bunch of other companies as well in the process. And for me personally, it was like an engineer's dream to be able to really work on something I liked a lot. The product really allowed you to really focus on solving problems and know that you'd always get the math right. And so for me personally, I started as a quality engineering lead, and I got firsthand to build the first test automation system that connected with our build and release system that was built at the MathWorks. And at that point, we had just introduced object-oriented programming into MATLAB. So it was a great way to dog food our capabilities and actually use MATLAB to test MATLAB. And I had really enjoyed that role because previously, when I was still in grad school, I had gotten an internship as a QA engineer, and I was working on computer-aided software tools was a thing when I was just getting out of college. And I really enjoyed learning about how to break code, if you will, to find all different ways the software might not work, and like really focus on what is the main user experience and then what are the edge cases and figure out how to automate all of that. And what I realized is that was the place I saw a lot of different things come together in terms of the assumptions you were making about the users, what is core to the product, and where do you want to really spend your time ensuring that the quality of what you're building exists, right? And so when I got this opportunity to interview at the MathWorks, I was just very excited. And I was also very excited that I would be starting in the quality engineering. And that's actually been an important aspect of my life, professional life anyway, to really always keep the user in mind. Because without the user in mind, without empathizing with what the user is doing, I pretty much feel like you're missing the point on the value you're trying to deliver. You really want to be able to enable people with your software to do what they want to accomplish. And you need to remove everything else as a distraction. I don't know if that answers your question.
It definitely does. Being an empathetic engineer, some folks feel that that's at odds with the fact that a lot of engineers are introverted and just kind of concentrating on code and maybe not taking that leap to mentally put themselves in the shoes of a user and what are their wants and needs? How would they use this? And how can I shape what I'm doing to better meet their needs and anticipate them? That's definitely a skill set that a lot of engineers would do well to emulate.
Yeah, I totally agree. Because one thing I'll say is when I was a student and using the product, I could not figure out why printing was so difficult in MATLAB. And it seemed like easy things were just hard. And then really bringing that into my career, because, you know, when you know it, experience it firsthand, then you know, like, okay, this is the pain I need to eliminate. So the one thing that was really great that I have brought forward in my career from the MathWorks is usability. Like whether it's just not things UIs, right? It's even APIs. Like how do you design for things that allow you to be in the zone and really use your product like in a more mainstream way? And you can be introverted and do it too. You can like actually observe people using your products. You can do a bunch of paper prototyping. I think the fundamental thing really is being willing to be open to understand and put yourself in somebody else's shoes.
Now, over the course of your time at MathWorks, you were an engineer and then you grew into being an engineering manager. What was the transition like? What were some of the challenges you ran into during that time?
Yeah, I didn't go in thinking I would be in management. I really wanted to solve problems. And I guess what I realized, I think, given the nature of the projects I was doing, there were things I could code by myself, but I was also working with groups of people, right? Like there was interaction, whether it was later on, like with the QA engineer or with usability or, you know, understanding how you fit into what you're building to get it right. It's not like you only sit and code. What I was beginning to realize was that there was talking and communication involved. But at the same time, I also had this in my head that management meant like Dilbert, a pointy-haired boss who really doesn't understand what is going on and you're explaining the same thing over and over again. And I felt like I'd be giving up something, my individuality or my ability to have direct impact. And when the opportunity did come, though, the reason I went forward to it is one of the mentors I had at the MathWorks, who actually helped me learn everything I know, all mistakes are mine, about development on the Microsoft platform, MFC, and all of that stuff. I really respected him a lot, and he had made the transition from being an individual contributor to leading a team lead. And one of the things he had said to me, which I later realized in my career in management, is that it's about leverage and impact that you can have. And it's much more broader than just yourself. It is also something that you can enable other people to have an impact as well. And really trying to get the team to align and perform, you just see a multiplicative factor. And that's something I thought was very interesting. I had not thought about management in that way. And I think over time, what I realized is what this individual who was my mentor, his name is Chris Norman, what he had actually meant was there's an African proverb that says, if you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to go far, go with others. So management is really a team sport. And what I also recognized over time is that it brings together components of technology or your subject matter expertise, whatever that is, along with process and people. So it's really pulling those things together to have a broader impact. And that's how I got into it. And I think what made it, I would say MathWorks had a path called a senior team lead path, which was really good in terms of me taking the plunge, if you will, because if you tried management and it was not your cup of tea, you could always go back to being an individual contributor. So I felt like there was a safety net. If I screwed up or really didn't like it, I could go back to being an individual contributor. And I felt like that was actually very helpful for me to know that I could explore this career path. And then if for whatever reasons they didn't work out, I could always go back to doing what I did.
So I have three young daughters, and someday one or more of them may end up in leadership or technology leadership. What would you tell a young woman now, or maybe the younger version of yourself, lessons learned or things that they should consider when moving up into a management role?
So looking at it from a couple different perspectives for me, both as a woman and coming from a different culture, a culture where I had to respect my elders and be deferential, I would say the first thing is to not be afraid to speak up, because I think the focus, if you put the focus more on the results you're trying to accomplish, and if you think more in terms of your ideas contributing and even helping, I think that diversity of thought is important, that you have something to contribute. I think when I began to feel confident that what I had to say was of value, and I had also shown results in terms of whether as an engineer, the work that I had done, or as a manager in terms of bringing teams together and delivering. And it's not about being right, it's about expressing your thoughts. And so just don't be afraid to share that, because people cannot read your mind and you have something to contribute. So I would say finding your voice and really standing up for what you believe in, I think is very important. And the other thing is really being visible. I feel that, again, from a cultural perspective, I really was very hesitant to talk about my accomplishments. It was almost like you're being too proud. You need to be humble. And I'd say you need to talk about yourself and what you've accomplished, because nobody else is going to do that for you. And people may not know. And, you know, relying on your manager to know and to advocate for you is putting a lot of pressure on them, because they're probably not going to be in situations where you are and they have a daytime job to do, right? And again, I would bring it back to your contributions. And if it makes you uncomfortable and you think you're tooting your own horn, then think about the greater goal. Think about what you're trying to accomplish as part of a team. And if you don't talk about that, then nobody else will. And then the other thing is that I realized is that you might inadvertently be hurting yourself, hurting your chances of getting different projects or growing your career when people don't know what you have accomplished or the skills that you have and that you can bring to the table. And so you need to advocate for yourself and don't leave it up to somebody else.
Hey, sport. How was school today?
It was okay, Dad. How was work?
Actually, I had a rough day. Leading an engineering team is hard. I mean, I have to ship new software, meet deadlines, and tackle new projects while keeping my team focused on the day-to-day. It's hard to keep up.
Jeepers, Dad. Why don't you call Syrinx? They're the software engineering firm run by software developers. They helped Billy's dad. He used to be stressed out like you. He was missing deadlines, his team was overworked, and a bunch of folks left the company because it was too stressful. But then he called Syrinx. And they put developers to work right away. He hit all his deadlines and freed up his team to do other work. His boss was so happy Billy's dad got some extra time off.
Time off? Wow. What did he do with that?
He spent it with Billy.
Aww. That's a swell idea, son. I'll call Syrinx today. Now, you go wash up for supper.
I think there's a way to do both of those. A lot of folks from an engineering background, you know, you go to school and like there's a right answer and there's a wrong answer, and everyone feels bad when they have the wrong answer. And public speaking, or maybe even just standing around in a 10-person scrum, can sometimes feel difficult to speak up and say what you think about something. But yeah, you have to muster the courage, and there's a way to do it that you don't have to offend everyone. You know, you could be like, yeah, your code sucks, you know, but instead you could be like, well, I have another way that we could do this. You might want to consider, here's why, and here's what I think may happen if we go down this route, and I think this will help alleviate that. What do you think?
I think that's great. In fact, there were a couple of tricks, if you will, that I learned over time. One is that I would start off by saying, this may be a silly or stupid question, but hear me out. And oftentimes what I've heard is that three other people have the same silly or stupid question. Nobody's willing to say that, right? And when I realized that, it was actually very liberating, right? Like, oh, because to a certain degree, we all have some common concerns. Like raise it, right? Air it out. The other thing I have found to be effective is to take the pressure off, or to make things not feel concrete that you're making a decision, to just say, let's try a thought experiment. Because when you say experiment and a thought, like you're leaving it out there that it is open for discussion. Like we're doing this together. Let's have a conversation going. And I think the example you gave about scrums, and you know, those are great avenues to, as an introvert, to like start speaking up. And I am actually introverted. It's taken me a long time to actually begin to talk in public, which is also very ironic because I used to be a debater, you know, back in high school and things like that. But what I have found in a professional setting, competition is one thing. You know, there you know, like something's on the line and, you know, you can go debate and all of that. In a work environment, what I found really was to get myself to speak, I would play a game in my head. And this game was, I don't care how silly I might look, but I'm going to ask one question in this meeting. And that's all I started with. What started with one question became two questions. And before you know it, I'm chatting up a storm, right? Because then you see that, okay, your question did make sense. Other people just didn't ask that. And this is the other thing, right? If you don't speak, I mean, I'm sure all of us have experienced, people will just take up air. There's going to always be some people who will just speak and not have any content, anything that's useful. Then I added one more thing to myself, which is like, I am going to be the defender of people sucking up air from the room. So I'm going to interject something into it so to balance out the conversation. I feel like a big part for me was to be okay to not be perfect, to be okay to say, let me try different things. Again, the engineer part of me wants to trial and error and experiment, tweak a parameter here, there, till you find the optimal solution. So that's what I would say is, don't take yourself too seriously, but you know, within limits of being professional, test the boundaries, experiment, and if not for yourself, do it for others.
Now, you also mentioned a bit of self-advocacy and self-promotion, if you will, to your manager about your accomplishments. And I think I agree with you 100%. Your manager's job is to get stuff done. It's part of their purview to advance your career too and make sure that you're doing well and that your achievements are recognized and so forth, but that's a minor part usually. So it's up to you to find a non-annoying way to persistently let them know about what you're doing. Hey, maybe you got a bug count to zero on some release, or maybe you figured out some problem. There's a way you could send out an email that's not like, I'm the greatest of the world, everybody kneel before me, but you can come off more as like a helpful person. Hey, I figured out what's going on with this. I wanted to share it with the team in case anyone else runs into it, blah, blah, blah. I discovered this thing. Hey, I got the bug count to zero. I got some cycles. If any of you guys need help with anything, let me know. It's a subtle, like, I finished all my work, but you're coming off as helpful, letting the whole team know, and then not necessarily braggy. Braggy and bossy, two negative connotations. Like, I've seen some literature that's been directed at my daughters about, don't be afraid of these words. Like, it's okay to be a strong, assertive female and be good at things and, you know, be in charge of things. What do you think of that?
Absolutely. I really like the choice of word you used, assertive versus aggressive. And I think that's where a gender connotation comes through, because if a guy were to do similar things, they would be assertive, whereas a woman would be aggressive, right? So I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. But, you know, being assertive is like really stating things in a manner where you know that you're able to back up what you're saying with how does this have an impact, right? And especially to your point of what you just said earlier, is help your manager solve problems. Don't create problems for them, because they have a job to do. They have to get things done. How can you be somebody that they can enroll to help solve those problems? Like, you know, by the coding you did, or you figured out a tool that really helps your team be more efficient in the way you're doing deploys or whatever, share it with them. You can celebrate that, right? Because now you're making your team efficient. And I think really trying to put it in the business context of how are we trying to do things more efficiently so we can solve our customer problems sooner, or we can enable our customers to solve their problems. And I think really bringing those things and really trying to figure out, as a team player, how can you do your part from your strengths to move the team forward so your manager is actually excited to talk to you and give you more responsibility or other things to engage you and help you grow your career. I'd say the other thing that you mentioned is that I believe, based on my experience, that you need to own your career. Your manager could be a coach. There could be somebody who can guide and help you, but it is not their job to manage your career. I personally believe it is an individual's responsibility. And I say this to my teams, if you don't have a plan, you're going to be part of somebody's plan, and you're probably not going to be happy where you land up with it. And a big part of that comes back again to your visibility and what you have done. And can you articulate what, not just the tasks you've completed, but how does that add value to your organization? And what skills have you developed in that process? Because you always want to be developing skills.
Always be learning.
Yep, and delivering too.
So I know you and some other folks spent quite a bit of time at MathWorks. What was the impetus to kind of move on?
Yeah, I think one thing I'd say is all good things come to an end. I'd start there. I think for me, it was more about trying to explore a different space. And also, I think I wanted to get an experience in terms of building more systems end to end and really getting a feel for what it would be to work at a smaller company with a more startup kind of a feel and really trying to do more end to end kinds of things. The point that also led me is that I felt like every 2-3 years, I was doing something different at the MathWorks. I really didn't have to look outside because I was learning skills and I was growing teams, and I felt like it was adding a lot of value. And they reached a point where I felt like I took pretty much all the training there was to take that was given by the company, and I was solving interesting problems, but I also felt kind of stagnant. And I felt like my rate of learning was not increasing. And I reflected on what really gave me enjoyment. And when I looked back in my career at the MathWorks, it was really figuring out how to use technology to solve problems. It's really trying to interact at the customer requirements level and understand what was going on. And I felt like over time, I was going deeper and deeper in the stack. And I felt like I needed to bubble up. And I had gone and gotten back to school, got an MBA. And I'm not saying that, you know, leave jobs because you have an MBA or anything like that. But for me, I was very curious about how to connect technology with business and really understand strategy in scoping things and creating things, if you will. And MathWorks had developed, and, you know, like a product that really accelerates the pace of science, technology, and accelerated discovery. And I was just curious about that whole process of how do you create value? And I decided to go get an MBA, but I also had, maybe this is the immigrant in me, like traveling so many miles away from home, always having this desire, I'm not there yet, what it would mean to start a venture of my own at some point in my career. I know there's also never a right time, but I was like, okay, what would I need, right? And I was like, okay, maybe I'll try business school. And after that, as part of my business school experience, what I realized was that I was much more multifaceted than only being an engineering manager. And I also felt like I wanted to be in a place where I could challenge myself and push myself a bit more out of the comfort zone to find ways to bring things to life and expand, not just be in the back end of things, but also create things. Because I had this limiting belief in myself that I would only be successful in the back end. And I had to like either prove to myself that was a limiting belief or I was really sucked at it. So what I ended up doing was running a much smaller team, but doing many things like being a scrum master to building product roadmaps to building the technology plan and also working with professional services and really understanding how enterprise products are built and being really going from if we didn't build it here, it's not good enough to like using open source more and really trying to pick and choose pieces and build a product in a very lean way.
You mentioned back at MathWorks that they had a program where you could try out management. If it didn't work, you could go back in individual contributor role, no harm, no foul. I think during your career, you may be tempted to try a new position, new company, new whatever. Why do you think financial literacy is important and having a little bit of a backstop in order to be able to take those risks?
I think financial literacy is important because as a woman, I think it's very important to have your economic independence, right? Because when you have that, when you're not so worried about where your next pay stub is going to come from, you have lots more optionality in the choices you might make, right? And time and math, like really simple math in terms of compounding interest, are your biggest assets in this. And if you start really young, whether it is 401k or, you know, just saving your money, especially if your company does a match, I think just go for it. That's just like free money. But also trying to diversify your portfolio. And, you know, it's not like you need to become a financial planner yourself, but some very simple rules of like, you know, dollar cost averaging, put out a certain amount every month, you get that big bonus, don't spend it, put it back in, and having a diversified portfolio. That's pretty much rudimentary, right? And then time and compound interest will do the rest. And what happens is as you grow your career or as you go into your career, you don't like something. If you have that cushion, then you're not beholden to either the environment or feel like you are stuck in a corner. You have choices. It could be going back to school, investing money, getting a different skill, or it could be, you know, going to a startup, you know, the risk versus reward. And I feel like that's why really the notion of doing a little and for the long run, giving yourself that optionality is always good because you don't know how the world will work out. None of us know, right? Like if I knew it, I wouldn't be sitting here. I'd probably be on an island sipping a beverage of some kind. But the best thing you can do absent that is look at your upside, right? Like what's the bang for the buck that you can get? And same thing with your career too. Give yourself many options so that you have choices.
I remember when I was leaving to my old company to start Syrinx, I had saved up some money and I had looked at things and said, okay, if everything craters, if I never find client number two and, you know, have to completely reboot, it's going to be okay. I've got a cushion now. I can fall back on that so I can afford to take a little risk. And I think that having the confidence to take that risk, a lot of engineering / introverted folks are like, I don't want to do that. But being able to feel like you have that cushion allows you to maybe spread your wings a little more and achieve things that you might not have thought possible otherwise.
Yeah. I think more importantly, it gives you the option to do what you enjoy doing, or at least you can choose where you want to spend your time, right? And it's pretty much the same concept for retirement. Retirement, in my mind, has nothing to do with age. It has everything to do with the amount of money you have and the lifestyle you can lead, right? And if you can accomplish that, if you know what you would need to spend, how you want to spend it, and do you have that, right? And so it has a lot to do about being financially smart and giving yourself that option. And for me personally, growing up, my parents had put a lot of emphasis on saving, right? They would always say, like, a rupee saved is a rupee earned. And, you know, I will disagree with one thing they taught me. And I think one thing I learned, both from B school and coming to the States, about debt and how to make debt work for you. But in India, when I was growing up, having debt was like a big no-no, right? If you couldn't afford something, you never bought it. At least in my family, it was very important that you were not owed to somebody, right? It was pretty important. And savings was a huge emphasis. Education and savings, I think, is like pretty big growing up. And so I was very hesitant about debt till I understood that debt could be a good leverage for you to use. And that's why, and I think you alluded to this too, credit card debt is bad, but there's other kinds of debt that are good for you.
Mortgage interest on a rental property.
Yeah, it's like leverage. So like being smart, and I personally feel that financial literacy should be the fourth R that we teach our kids, because I feel like not just kids, even adults don't know what to do with their finances. And I'm not saying you need to be an accountant and you should be able to do your taxes or anything like that. I'm just talking about simple mathematics of socking away something and giving yourself that cushion.
I think it's the same thing you said about careers. If you don't make your own plan, you're going to be part of someone else's plan. You may not like where you end up.
Exactly. And some wise person said that to me a long time ago, and I took that to heart.
So, Nasheen, any other parting thoughts or tips for folks from your experiences?
Yeah, I would say in terms of career growth, besides having your plan, I would say really focus on your strengths, what you're really good at, because I feel like we over vector on all the things we have to improve on. So we really focusing on your strengths is what I would say. And the second thing I would say is get out of your comfort zone, stretch yourself, try different things, because I believe, and I think there's a saying that goes, that growth really happens when you operate at the edge of your comfort zone. So
there's no growth in the comfort zone, and there's no comfort in the growth zone.
Exactly.
Words to live by. Nasheen, thank you very much for coming in and participating and being a guest on Underserved.
Andrew, thanks so much for having me. It's been my pleasure.
And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.